The new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
This week has been one of the craziest weeks that we've had in quite a while when it comes to the case of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Karen Reed. I knew that things were heating up and tension seems to be rising, but it hit a big boiling point this week during a pretrial hearing, to the point where the judge actually called a recess and then came back to the bench shaking and then suspended the rest of the day's proceedings because she said that she had, quote unquote, grave concerns. News outlets that haven't even been following the case were reporting on this. And there was, not surprisingly, a lot of misinformation being spread. Some big accusations were made, and a huge misrepresentation that have some people saying that it was intentional, and some people saying it had to have been a mistake. We'll go over it so that you can decide what you think. We also have a sit-down with Karen Reed and Alan Jackson for Boston 25, a new federal filing, plus, the very first interview with a juror from Karen's first trial. As always, there's a lot to cover, so let's jump right in. On Saturday, February 15th, Aidan Carney, aka Turtle Boy, did something that no other journalist has been able to do so far. He landed an interview with one of the jurors from Karen Reed's first trial. The juror's name is Ronnie, and he spent about 2.5 hours answering questions and giving some insight into how the jury viewed the case, the evidence, and Karen Reed. Now, there are some things in the interview that really surprised me, and some other things that unfortunately did not. First and foremost, this juror confirmed that they all agreed on not guilty for the murder charge and leaving the scene of an accident.
So do you confirm that it was a 12-0 vote for acquittal on murder and leaving the scene of an accident?
That is correct. So that was what the entire group agreed upon. That being said, it was confusing because we didn't have very clear direction on if it was all or nothing. In other words, if all three convictions had to be 100%. So that's why the response that it was that we were continued to need to deliberate because it was not clear on that one charge. So the one charge that we were not very clear on and not everybody was in agreement with was essentially the manslaughter charge, involuntary manslaughter. So that was the one that we were not clear on. But the other two charges, which was essentially second degree murder, as well as leaving a scene of an accident, was very clear. We all 12 agreed that was not the case.
Now, I am starting with this interview and this clip because I really want to make sure that this part sinks in. Karen Reed had 12 jurors who all agreed that she was not guilty of second-degree murder. That's the requirement for an acquittal. 12 jurors who all agree that she's not guilty. Not one juror believed that Karen Reed murdered John O'Keefe. Not one. Yet now, Karen Reed is about to have to go on trial for murder again. All because the system is set up in such a way that it doesn't matter what the jurors agreed to or decided because it wasn't read aloud in court. That's crazy to me. Now she has to go convince another 12 jurors that she's not guilty of murder. The whole point of double jeopardy is to prevent this from happening. Now, I've talked before about how the presumption of innocence isn't necessarily something that is ingrained in us, although it is a fundamental principle of due process. In order to receive a fair trial, you must go into this thinking that the defendant is innocent, and you must make the prosecution prove otherwise. I know that's hard sometimes, especially because you want to believe that law enforcement is doing their job properly, and you want to believe that the prosecutors aren't going to prosecute a case that they know they can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And sometimes, the most emotional part of it, you want to believe that the victim is getting justice for what happened to them. I've been in courtrooms and watched the family members of the deceased struggle through each part of a trial. I've watched them cry during testimony about the last moments of their loved one's life. I've seen the pain in their faces as a medical examiner describes what happened to them in emotionally detached detail. I've hugged them in the courthouse hallways when they made it through another hard day, knowing they'll have another sleepless night and then have to come back and do it all again tomorrow. The road to justice is often brutal, messy, emotional, and exhausting. Being in the courtroom for a murder trial is not like what you see on TV and movies. In Hollywood, you can pretty much always count on a nice, clean ending. The truth will come out, the bad guy will get caught, and the good guys can celebrate their role in justice being served for a victim and their family. But Hollywood is not real life. Sometimes the truth doesn't come out. The details remain unclear, and there are no good guys and bad guys, only people with different perspectives, different theories, and different jobs. We want to believe that if someone is sitting at a defendant's table, that means that they're there for a reason. When we hear that someone was arrested for a crime, we want to think, heck yeah, they got the guy. And when we see a family who lost a loved one struggling and in pain, we want to be a part of the process that brings them some relief. Because of that, the presumption of innocence is often subconsciously put behind the need for closure and the perception of what justice should look like. This is what was going through my head during most of the interview that Carney did with the juror from Karen Reed's first trial. There was one main thing that the juror kept repeating when he explained why the jurors were hung up on guilty for the manslaughter charge.
There were some individuals who just looked at the facts. Again, the clear fact that Karen was operating a vehicle and drove the vehicle to that location, 34 Fairview. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately John O'Keefe lay at rest and died on essentially that address. And so everybody else is saying that he never entered the premises, therefore she must be at fault because he clearly did not just injure himself there. So,
I mean, that's a little scary when you think about it. It's a conclusion that's not based on the evidence, but rather lack of evidence. It's like saying, well, she's the one on trial and she was there, so it must be her. That's really terrifying to think that people are willing to convict on that process. One other thing that the juror did confirm, though, was that nobody was convinced by the Commonwealth trying to portray Karen as angry and vindictive, and that's why she allegedly killed John. That was a big stretch, and we all knew that. The only ones who really buy that are the dedicated online warriors who want people to believe that Karen was angry and vengeful so that they can justify telling everyone that she's guilty. The jury saw through it like most everybody else, though.
So to believe that Karen Reed was not guilty of murder, that means that even if they thought that she did it for some reason, not a single person on that jury thought that she did it on purpose, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so the whole motivation with about the Aruba trip with the Sullivan girls, and she's all angry. So that didn't really play well with you guys. That wasn't convincing.
It wasn't convincing. No.
There are a few other key points from the interview that stood out to me. There were two jurors who wanted to ask the judge about voting for each count individually, since they had all agreed on counts 1 and 3, but apparently, the foreman and some other strong personalities shot them down.
One of the questions that we wanted to ask the judge was for a clarification on, can we look at these charges individually? But ultimately, that kind of question was put down. And essentially, we had no choice but to just, again, based on the group, right, or majority rule, to say that we were just going to ask one question, or it's an all or nothing scenario, as opposed to can be treated individually from each other or independently.
But you wanted to ask the judge, are we allowed to come to a decision on two of the charges and hang on the third? And the foreman said, that's not going to happen. No.
And it wasn't necessarily just the foreman, but there was a bunch of other opinionated individuals also kind of saying that, no, I think we have to look at it as a whole as opposed to independent. But clearly the person who was in charge at the time was the foreman. So their word was more pronounced.
That's really unfortunate, because voting on the charges separately is how the justice system is supposed to work. Telling the jurors that it's all or nothing is the opposite of how it's supposed to work. And now Karen Reed is being tried for two crimes that she should have already been acquitted of, if the jury had been more clear of how to handle it. Another thing that stood out is that the jurors felt like Brian Albert and the other witnesses being present during closing arguments was intimidating, especially with them sitting right across the small room, staring directly at the jury.
It was a little intimidating. And I say intimidating, it was just at the end. I think it was, we're all at that point where we want this to have some closure. And I think it was slightly intimidating to see everybody there and all the players there, to some respect. I wouldn't say so much that I was fearful, but intimidated by everybody staring at me.
The jurors also felt like Higgins destroying his phone was suspicious, obviously. They thought that Dr. Russell wasn't taken as seriously because Lally said that Dr. Russell is the one who reached out to the defense. The ARCA experts weren't taken as seriously because the jury thought that someone had hired them to keep everyone from thinking that there was a wreck. They were thinking maybe it was an insurance company who hired them, or the Reed family, or even Turtle Boy.
It was very ambiguous on why these individuals were testifying. And so there was a question in the group on their essential integrity in terms of, were they there as a direct result of somebody else trying to steer us in a different direction and confuse the jury. So it wasn't sure if it was insurance. It wasn't sure if it was, you know, whether the Reeds were doing it, somebody else was doing it, or yourself was doing it to
myself.
Bring this group to try to testify so that it would sway the jury in one direction or the other. And that, I think that was one of the things that was, again, unfortunate, because I guess it cannot be said or didn't want to be revealed to us on what were the circumstances of why those individuals were testifying, other than they were testifying for the defense.
It seems, listening to the interview, like the jurors kind of disregarded all expert testimony. Some of the jurors with medical background relied on their own expertise to question the injuries that John sustained, understanding that it isn't consistent with a pedestrian collision with a car. But it's interesting that all that time and money spent on experts and the jurors just kind of brushed it all off. They also brushed off Trooper Paul's testimony, but that's to be expected. That one was a disaster. But they didn't know about the federal investigation. And Juror Ronnie thinks that it could have possibly made a big difference if they did. The biggest takeaway from the interview that I got was that jurors really don't understand reasonable doubt, and they don't always follow jury instructions. You can find the full interview on Carney's YouTube channel, youtube.com/turtleboylive. We'll be right back after this. Karen Reed and her attorney, Alan Jackson, sat down with Ted Daniel at Boston 25 for an interview that aired on Super Bowl Sunday. The interview gave some insight into what life is like for Karen Reed as she awaits her second trial. And there were a few interesting little bombs that were dropped as well. Karen was asked about some of the online vitriol surrounding the case and whether or not she pays attention to some of what's being said.
There are bad, evil, nefarious players in this. Doesn't drag me down in any way. It makes me feel like we're covering ground here. The nastier it gets, the more I know that we're making an impact to people that have a lot to worry about.
Karen also reflected on John, saying that she thinks a lot about his final days. Karen and her defense team have John's full phone information, which she says reads like a diary. She has mixed feelings looking back on John because she said that there's a lot of poor decisions from both of them that led to John's death and the nightmare that she's now living.
I have very mixed feelings, you know, when I look back on John, because I see a lot of poor decisions that were all precursors to his death and to this nightmare that I'm living. It's...
Poor decisions by whom?
By both of us. Just drinking, being around the wrong people is chief among them. Wrong people for the weeks leading up. They wouldn't have been people I would have chosen on my own to be around.
Karen says she has a very small inner circle, and half of that circle consists of her attorneys, who she talks to multiple times per day. She's a big advocate for herself. Alan Jackson says that Karen has encyclopedic knowledge of this case and looks at it with an analyst's brain. He says the main strategy for the defense team is to get the truth out there. Jackson said in his 30-year career, he's never seen a case with this many issues with the conduct of the witnesses, the district attorney, law enforcement, and basically everyone involved. He says they'll stay aggressive in their strategy until the truth comes out. In terms of the jury, Jackson points out that the person in charge of governing the jurors in the first trial was also the direct supervisor of some of the law enforcement witnesses who took the stand. That's a major issue that should have never happened, and this happened under their noses the entire trial. They weren't even made aware of it until about 10 minutes before Jackson was about to stand up and give the closing arguments. He also notes that the jurors who, based on expressions and body language, seemed to be the most supportive of the defense, were all dismissed within minutes of deliberations. And that's too convenient not to pay attention to, especially with everything else that's happened. As far as Proctor's vile texts that were read in court, Karen said she's proud of overcoming her health crises, and nothing that he texted and admitted out loud in court could ever offend her. She's just glad that now people can see who he really is. Jackson also gave some of his thoughts on Proctor.
That man should not ever carry a badge. That man should not ever carry a gun. He should never have any authority over the community members ever again.
Are you surprised that he's been fighting for his job?
Yeah. Yeah. What I think he should probably do is put his tail between his legs and get out of the jurisdiction and go find some other line of work, someplace where he can't hurt people.
Jackson says the prosecution wants to erase Proctor from the minds of the public and from the new jury. But you can't do that. He's touched every part of this case. And if the prosecution doesn't call him as a witness this time, the defense will. Karen and Jackson were also asked about the ARCA witnesses, which will be discussed a lot more later in this episode.
The fact that we didn't hire them,
They can't be considered hired guns by the prosecution. The fact that the Commonwealth didn't even know their name. They were completely independent third parties who did not know Karen Reed or this case, and they did not know that their assessment was attendant to Karen Reed or this case. Central to their testimony, as one of the witnesses testified, the physics don't lie. The science doesn't lie. The car did not make contact with John O'Keefe. She didn't do this.
Karen didn't have access to the federal information and reports because of the protective order. So a lot of the details of what was said in ARCA's report, she didn't even learn until trial. She said it was another moment where she realized how underhanded the prosecution was, that they would have access to this report, try to suppress it, and still continue to try to prosecute this case. Karen was asked about her previous comments, wondering if she had hit John with her car. She said that she was going through every possibility trying to figure out what could have happened because the thought never crossed her mind that the people that they were with that night could have done something to John. When she was asked what she thinks happened, this was her response.
If John was beaten up and attacked in that house, who did it?
We don't know.
We don't know.
We don't know. And it's not for us to know. Somebody other than Karen. Somebody other than Karen is responsible for that, for the killing of John. But who it was specifically, others know. And they're not talking.
Jackson says in the next trial, we can expect to hear some new information. And the defense team is constantly getting tips because the public is very interested in getting to the truth about what happened. And they're going to fight as hard as they can to make sure that the truth comes out. As far as John's family goes, Karen said that she's received messages from his brother, Paul. It's surprising to hear that Paul has sent messages to Karen, especially because of the stay-away order.
He hasn't in a while, but he's attempted to send me Facebook messages. It's ironic because there's a stay-away order, and yet I hear, they've attempted to send me messages, and as soon as I see the name comes up, I just delete it. I'm not interested in anything he has to say to me.
Paul O'Keefe was a big topic during the first trial because he sat right on the side of Karen facing the defense table. And he's often seen on camera glaring at Karen during testimony and breaks. She was asked what she thought about the content of those messages. And this is her response.
Negative, volatile. I mean, there was some volatility in court.
Can you feel him staring at you?
I honestly don't even know he's there anymore. I mean, I'm aware that his immediate family's in the courtroom, but Paul sitting there doesn't impact me, it doesn't bother me. That's John's brother.
Karen says that she cared for John and John cared for her. Something tragic happened, and while she is sidelined, she won't be permanently broken. As far as what her future holds going into the second trial, she said she's going to be okay, regardless of what happens.
Even if a jury got it wrong, or there's even more nefarious behavior on behalf of this prosecution, then just even more awareness will be raised. So I can accept whatever happens. Nothing will ever get the best of me or break me down.
Not surprisingly, Hank Brennan filed a motion to get all of the footage from Boston 25 before the interview even aired. It can be viewed in its entirety at youtube.com/Boston25News. So we have a quick update on the appeals process. On February 18th, Karen's team filed a habeas motion with the federal court. So basically what this means is that they think that the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts got it wrong when they denied her appeal. And she wants the federal court to take a look at it and grant her appeal, dismissing counts 1 and 3 so that she's not subjected to double jeopardy. The Commonwealth has until next week to respond, and there will be a federal hearing scheduled for this on March 5th. So we'll see what happens. Now, the prosecution and the defense have both been very busy filing all kinds of motions, and we'll hear more about them in future hearings, but I want to quickly touch on a few of these so that we know what to expect and we can keep an eye on what's going on with them. Now, in episode 38, I mentioned that Proctor's texts were back in court filings. Specifically, the defense mentioned a text that Proctor sent Lally saying that he didn't watch the closing arguments given by Jackson, and he called Jackson an asshole. Well, 3 days after the defense filed that motion, the Commonwealth responded with a motion of their own, asking that the judge impose sanctions on the defense for including a text from Proctor. Now, the Commonwealth is saying that there is a protective order that was issued that prohibits the public dissemination of all communications, including from Proctor's cell phone. They're saying that the defense is saying that it was only for personal identifying information and only the screenshots are protected, not what the texts say. So they both have different versions of what they believe that the protective order is supposed to protect. Now, here's the thing. Proctor called Jackson a name, and that text was put in a defense court filing. The purpose of the protection order, according to the Commonwealth in this motion, is to effectuate the well-established privacy and safety interests of witnesses and protect the integrity of ongoing investigations. Now, if this was his work phone, like they mentioned, that's not really private in a situation like this where Proctor's dug himself such a large hole, and this is probably going to come out at the trial anyway. But putting that aside, Proctor has said a lot worse. So his safety would have been more in danger before than just with calling Jackson an asshole. But here's my other thought on this. Maybe it has nothing to do with Proctor. Brennan says in the last paragraph of this motion that he wants the judge to make every motion that is filed under seal, as in the public won't have access to it. They sure do love to keep the public out of public information up in Massachusetts. And we all know that the defense is about to file a motion to dismiss that's going to be full of all the misconduct of the people involved here. And for good reason. But I can't help but wonder if all of this is just to keep the word from getting out about just how bad things are. So we'll see. Now, the Commonwealth also responded to the defense's motion to keep Dr. Crosby, the PhD dog aggression guy, from testifying. Brennan says that Dr. Crosby is qualified to testify as an expert in dog bite wounds. He says that he has extensive experience teaching, writing, and employment in this area. Now, some of the examples are that he has developed a curriculum for police and law enforcement regarding the proper use of force in canine encounters. Now, this was odd to me, since one of the big arguments from the Commonwealth about Dr. Russell is that she was trained in police canines, and Chloe wasn't a police canine. But now they're using police canine experience as a reason to let Dr. Crosby testify. But whatever. Brennan also says that Dr. Crosby uses proper methodology, and he explains why he thinks so. And he uses the filing as a way to take some jabs at Dr. Russell. He seems kind of salty that he spent two full days in a hearing trying desperately to get Dr. Russell excluded, only to turn around and have her not be excluded and have her write an affidavit on why his expert should be excluded. For example, he says in the response that Dr. Crosby has been accepted and testified as an expert in numerous courts. And then in the footnotes, he says Dr. Russell, on the other hand, has never testified as an expert witness in court relative to dog bite wounds prior to Karen's trial. Now, it should be noted, however, that he didn't say what Dr. Crosby had been qualified to testify about. He just said that he'd been qualified as an expert. And he also didn't say that Dr. Russell has been qualified as an expert a lot of other times, just throwing in that one thing about the dog bite wounds. So, I don't know. Brennan is so misleading on so many things that it's really hard to cut through what's real and what's not in his motions. This will be argued in a hearing coming up, so we'll hear a lot more about it. And finally, the Commonwealth filed their pretrial conference report. They expect to have a buffer zone around the courthouse again to keep the protesters and Karen Reed supporters from being near the courthouse itself, and they expect to call about 50 witnesses. They say that their case should take about 20 full days of trial. Now, they also said that the automatic discovery was completed, but they're still turning in discovery even today. So, we'll see. We'll be right back after this. That brings us to our main event. A motions hearing was scheduled for February 18th, with quite a few things on the agenda. Now, some of them were addressed, but the hearing ended abruptly when Judge Cannone said that she had grave concerns about the information that she had just received. And we'll get to that, and I'm going to dissect it in great detail. But first, let's go through the rest of the hearing. Let's look at the quick ones and kind of get those out of the way first. Brennan filed a motion for everything from Boston 25's interview with Karen Reed. No biggie here, they'll have it all turned over to him in a couple of weeks. Then, the motion that I mentioned in the previous episode, where the defense is asking for access to John O'Keefe's car and the driveway, that was also addressed. Now, an attorney on behalf of the O'Keefes submitted an affidavit to the court in response to the defense's request. So, they are agreeing to the testing, or the access, I should say, but they had a few issues with some of the specifics of the defense's request. Basically, Paul O'Keefe was present when the Commonwealth did their testing, but the defense asked that none of the family members be within 200 feet of the cars when they do their testing. Now, the O'Keefe's attorney said that they're cool with the defense doing their thing, getting access in the driveway, but they don't want the court to grant the part about them not being able to be within 200 feet. Now, if that doesn't work, they said that they at least want an independent observer there to supervise the defense team in the driveway. Now, when this is brought up during the hearing, David Iannetti says that Brennan just gave him a drive today that appears to have the 3D scans that they were wanting. So that may be enough for them to use so that they won't actually need access to the driveway or the car. So no action was taken on that. It looks like they may be able to do everything from there. Okay, next up is a big one. Now, the importance of this got overshadowed by the dramatics from how the hearing ended, but it's important to really understand this motion and the response to it. This is for the forensically sound Sallyport video. Now, as a reminder, the defense sent an expert to Canton PD to get all the video and the metadata or anything that comes with it. Now, the expert gets there and there's nothing on the drive older than 30 days. So the defense expert asks if there are any original files in possession of Canton PD. So Colleen Crawford, you'll remember that name, called Brennan from Canton PD, and Brennan told Colleen Crawford to tell the expert to get it from the defense, knowing that the defense doesn't have it. If they did, the expert wouldn't be there. So the defense expert leaves empty-handed. Then Brennan goes to Canton PD after the expert is gone, and miraculously, more video appears out of nowhere at Canton Police Department. Poof, more video after 3 years of the defense being told that they have everything there is. It's a Canton miracle. So Brennan met with a retired detective who said he believed he had a copy of the footage from January 29th on an iCloud account. That still blows my mind, but yet here we are. So they plan on downloading everything from this random iCloud account that has now been mentioned for the first time. Now, after the last hearing, when all of this is brought up, Jackson and Iannetti stayed to talk to Brennan and Miss McLaughlin from the DA's office to try to work out an agreement on how to go about getting this video footage. So they come to the agreement that the defense won't need to fly out an expert again if the Commonwealth will just video record the process of them downloading the video footage from this iCloud account. The Commonwealth would then give them the download of everything. Problem solved. All good, right? Wrong. Alan Jackson says in the hearing that after all this was agreed upon, Miss McLaughlin from the DA's office emailed them and basically changed what they had been told. So it went from, you have all the video footage there is, to, oops, here's some more footage, oops, here's some more, oops, here's some more, to, you can come see what footage there is, to, oops, there's no more footage, to, oh, my bad, we did find some footage, and it's on an iCloud account. Now it's, oh, well, no, it's not on an iCloud account. It's on what they are calling the department's video file system. This is the newest story. So, Attorney Little wasn't at this meeting after the hearing where they made the agreement to video the iCloud download process. But obviously, she's a big part of the defense team. So, she got the email from Miss McLaughlin saying, oh, my bad, it's a video file system, not an iCloud account. So, she emails back and says, okay, this is a much more formal system than just an iCloud account. So yeah, no problem, download the videos. But those videos will also have metadata on them. So we want the metadata and log files associated with each video. Thanks. Not a crazy request. It's on a formal file system, so it should have metadata. They want that. And why wouldn't they, given the inverted videos and the time missing and the videos showing up years later? This has been a major issue in this case, so of course they want the metadata. Easy fix, Commonwealth has it, they can download it with that, right? Well, Wrong. Nothing is easy with the Commonwealth, and especially with Brennan.
When we asked for that additional metadata and the log files, Mr. Brennan, in my opinion, took an odd position, which is, nope, we had an agreement. We met right back there in that room. We said that you could videotape the download of the videos. You don't get anything else. If you want anything else, go to court and file a motion, which is why we had to file this motion. We don't think that it was necessary. This is metadata that is literally in the Commonwealth's possession as we speak. They have it. We're entitled to it. It's simple. That's all we're asking for.
Seems pretty straightforward, right? Jackson ends his argument with this.
Mr. Brennan made a point of saying, when he first came on this case, look, we want to give Ms. Reed a fair trial. We want to be as transparent as possible. And my hope is that was not just lip service for the media.
So Brennan refuses to download the metadata along with the videos that are in their possession. Then he tells Jackson he needs to go file a motion for it if he wants it, right? Well, Brennan filed his response, and like a lot of his other court filings, he uses it as a chance to take jabs when he can. He says that the Commonwealth is being unnecessarily bogged down by the defense's needless attempts to complicate the process. This is coming from somebody who has randomly sprinkled Sallyport video throughout the course of 3 years. But okay, cool. He also complains about Ms. Little responding to Ms. McLaughlin's emails. He says, quote, although she had not been in court on February 6th and did not participate in the party's meeting and agreement, Attorney Little began lodging emails attempting to alter and change the agreement that was already made between parties. In a progressive series of self-serving emails, Attorney Little filed the instant motion, including her own emails, end quote. So McLaughlin tells the defense that what they had all agreed on isn't what's happening. Little responds, and Brennan gets sassy about it. Then Brennan tells them to file a motion, so they do, and he gets salty about that too. It gets worse. Brennan, aka the Commonwealth, whines about the defense claiming quote-unquote entitlement for metadata and a forensically sound copy of this video. His arguments are just as snarky and rude as his court filings. Here's how he starts his response.
It seems like another effort to portray some type of injustice wrought upon the defense that half the facts are left out of the presentation.
So here's Brennan's story. He says he told the defense to file a motion because he doesn't trust them because they made representations that weren't accurate. That statement will come back to bite him in the butt at the end of this hearing, but he says he invited the defense expert to come to Canton PD. It wasn't lip service for the media. He was trying to accommodate the defense. He says that when he went to Canton PD, he talked to the retired sergeant who told him that he would download videos upon request. He never downloaded a 24-hour period because he says he was never asked to. Now, he says that this retired sergeant told him when he would make copies of the videos, he would download them, and he had a file on the hard drive at his office that he labeled detective file. So he would click and drag a copy of whatever he decided to copy. Click and drag, that's it. He said there's no metadata, there's no logs, just some retired dude's click and drag files on an external hard drive. Now, Brennan loves theatrics, and he repeats all the time how he's so fair and he cares so much about being transparent and he's so concerned with justice, etc., etc. But then he throws around dramatic, theatrical comments like this.
And now it has become part of the spirit of their argument of oppression that somehow there's something odd or miraculously hidden about this. It is simply video that the sergeant clicked and dragged to another file that we can go in, click and drag it to a hard drive, and give them a copy.
Brennan goes through this argument where he acts like it's crazy that the defense wants the metadata. I guess he's trying to pretend like all of these issues with the video footage haven't been happening for 3 years, but he continues to blame the defense for wanting to know where all of this footage is coming from and who has had access to it. Metadata is requested and used in trials all the time, and Brennan knows that. This whole thing is just theatrics. Jackson responds by pointing out that he isn't concerned with Brennan's confidence. He's concerned with his obligations. And this isn't about oppression. This is about fairness. They've been told since day one, before the trial, that there's no further video evidence. But yet, video evidence just keeps appearing in whatever form it keeps appearing in. Brennan didn't even discuss the metadata in his argument. He just focused on the theatrics instead of the issue. And Jackson says he doesn't know why the Commonwealth is making this so hard. Brennan says it's all beyond his duty. We still don't even know what's on the hard drive, and the fact that the story keeps changing about what exists and where it exists is wild and highly problematic, although the Commonwealth doesn't really seem to care. Now, next up is the motion to add attorney Mark Bedrow to the defense team, pro hoc vice. Now, Judge Cannone tells Yannetti that she needs an affidavit from him for it, and she will probably allow it unless there's an opposition, which she says is rare. But Brennan's middle name is rare, and he's ready to argue about everything. Judge Cannone gets ready to move on to the next motion, but Brennan wants to be heard on the pro hoc vice for Bedrow. He says he's not opposing it because having counsel of your choice is a fundamental right, but he wants to talk about it anyway. He brings up the fact that Bedrow is representing Aidan Carney in his witness intimidation charges that were filed against him for alleged harassment of witnesses in this case. Now, to be clear, if both Carney and Karen sign a defense agreement, then there's no conflict, so Bedrow can represent them both. There's a reason that Brennan wants to be heard here, but he's not giving an opposition. It's basically because he really doesn't have a leg to stand on when it comes to the opposition, but he wants to be heard because he likes to use his theatrics to try to convince people that something is wrong. But there's nothing really wrong here with Bedrow legally being able to join the defense team. Now, Brennan wants to point out that Bedrow and Bradle, Carney's two attorneys, have a mutual assistance type relationship with the defense attorneys in this case. Not surprising, and also not a conflict. He also wants to point out that Karen Reed and Aidan Carney have a connection where they also speak and share information. Again, no problem there. Brennan even acknowledges that he's not entitled to any product of a mutual defense, but then he pounds on the podium and talks about how it's curious that Carney and Karen aren't co-defendants, and it's curious that the indictments against Carney are dealing with witnesses in this case, and it's curious that a relationship of some sort exists between them. Now, Brennan says he isn't entitled to find out the nature of their relationship, but suggests that the judge could delve into that herself. He then says that Bedrow will be serving two masters if he joins the defense team here, and he says he has good reason to be concerned about the protected information in this case not being leaked and distributed to the media and the press. He brings up the witnesses in this case who he says have allegedly been harassed and abused, and he said he's not objecting, but Bedrow joining the team makes it more complicated. Now, Yannetti said that he will address those things in his affidavit, and the judge can make her decision about it after that. We'll be right back after this. Next up is the motion to reconsider the reciprocal discovery order. Now, this is the one where the defense is saying that the Commonwealth was able to coach and prep the witnesses on the things the defense was planning to impeach them on. So this go-round, they're wanting the judge to make it so that they don't have to turn over impeachment stuff until after the witnesses testify. Yannetti argues that this affects their ability to do effective cross-examinations. For example, the Jen McCabe trip to Sergeant Lank's house. Now, Brennan's argument is that he doesn't want trial by ambush, and he throws some shade at how things were done in the first trial, saying that there was discovery that wasn't turned over until way later. I'm looking at you, Sallyport Video and Jen McCabe Report. But regardless, Brennan says that he wants the order to remain in place, and he closes this argument by saying, hopefully, this time, it will be abided by. The hypocrisy just irks me, y'all. There's two more motions, and I saved the most explosive two for last. Now let's talk about the defense's request for specific discovery. The first thing that they're asking for is all chain of custody logs, reports, and evidence logs, and any other documentation about how the Norfolk County DA and the state police each got those Canton Police Department videos. Now this is a normal request, and I'm actually shocked that we're going into the second trial and this still hasn't been produced. But Attorney Little brings up the fact that there are multiple clips of videos handed over. One's missing crucial moments when Karen's car was brought into the Sallyport. Another was handed over in the middle of trial and it was inverted. And a third was just given recently, and it shows Higgins on the phone outside at 1:30 a.m. Now, as of now, the only report that they have is from Colleen Crawford. I told y'all that y'all would hear that name come back up. She reviewed the video surveillance footage and basically just summarized what she looked at. Now, here's the thing. There's no chain of custody logs and no reports about how any of this evidence got to them. I don't understand how evidence with no chain of custody is allowed in as credible evidence at a trial. And I don't understand how there's no chain of custody from police video. Ms. Little even says the Commonwealth can't skirt their Brady obligations by failing to memorialize things in reports. They just need the basic reports of who got this evidence and when. Now, when Brendan gets up to argue his objections to these requests, he starts his argument like this. And I really want you to listen to this sentence because it becomes very important when the bomb goes off in the courtroom in just a little while.
It's important to represent facts accurately. And the court has ordered in the past when representations have been made that they be accurate.
I want y'all to remember that. So basically, Brennan's big argument here is that there is no chain of custody. He says if there was, the defense would get the chain of custody logs that they want, but there's no chain of custody. So Brennan says that he's going to talk to the retired sergeant and whoever else and see if he can figure out where the videos came from, who touched them, and get someone to write a report. No chain of custody. Hey, y'all, here's some random clips that are inverted and missing time, and we don't know who touched them or where they got them, but yeah, use them as evidence in a murder trial. Just trust us. Totally checks out. Now, the next thing the defense is asking for is the information regarding the people involved in the Sandra Birchmore case. Attorney Little calls them by name.
First responding officer, Sergeant Link. Detective, Kevin Albert. Trooper, Mike Dunn. Trooper, Zach Clark. Colleen Crawford, Lieutenant John Fanning, Trooper Guarino, Lieutenant Brian Tully, Trooper Kathleen Prince, and Norfolk County District Attorney Michael Morrissey.
A lot of familiar names, right? So these people are all involved in the investigation that cleared Matthew Farwell for the murder of Sandra Birchmore. And now, here they are in this trial, they're material witnesses in this trial as well.
The parallels in these two cases could not be clearer. It's the same material witnesses, same investigators, same prosecutors, same failure to investigate a law enforcement officer who should have been a suspect.
So there's a specific report that the defense is requesting that deals with some of these witnesses. They say that this report is so heavily redacted that they can't really tell what's in it. And this information goes directly to the credibility of these witnesses. Now, the defense should be able to use this to say, hey, remember this one case just a year before this one where you cleared the cop who murdered this person instead of making them a suspect? Now, the report that they're asking for deals with Lieutenant Fanning, who is not only part of the case, but also was apparently in charge of the jury, and Trooper Kathleen Prince. They've also requested an unredacted copy of all reports, communications, and notes from the Sandra Birchmore investigation concerning the same law enforcement witnesses that are in this case. Now, this is from the Sandra Birchmore investigation concerning the same law enforcement witnesses. This is relevant stuff. This is not a surprising request. Ms. Little gives the example of Trooper Guarino, the one who is going to have the hardest time with the Sandra Birchmore material being used against him.
For example, Massachusetts State Police Trooper Guarino, the same person who obtained and analyzed the electronic devices in our case and reached certain opinions and conclusions, also analyzed electronic data in the Birchmore investigation. As it turns out, Trooper Guarino made certain ultimate conclusions in at least one of his reports, stating that really there's nothing to see here. I found some text messages. They corroborate that Matthew Farwell had a consensual relationship with Sandra Birchmore. No evidence of improper conduct. Nothing to see here.
Now, let me be clear. You cannot have a consensual sexual relationship with a minor. Minors cannot give consent. Sandra was a minor. He began grooming her and then sexually assaulted her. There is no consent in that. It's grooming. But the consensual thing isn't the biggest issue here. When the feds took over, they found 30,000 texts between Farwell and Sandra. Texts that proved that he had groomed her and that he's guilty of statutory rape of a child. Not to mention the texts that were used as evidence against him in her murder. Obviously, this is important. This shows that these troopers are either completely incompetent and chose not to look at any evidence against a fellow cop, or they lied to cover up for a fellow cop. And neither of those situations are good for the prosecution here. There are a ton of parallels here. The same people showing that they lack major credibility and that they either lie or look the other way when it comes to investigating other cops. This isn't the kind of information that a jury needs to have blocked from them. But Brennan being Brennan gets up and says this.
It's odd that it's important during argument to mention that there's an ongoing federal investigation and then list a number of witnesses for the Commonwealth, implying somehow something's nefarious. That these witnesses are involved in this other controversial case that has nothing to do with this case that the defense would like to parasite onto.
This is about the point of the day where I started gritting my teeth and muting my microphone so that I could freely say what I was thinking. Parasite onto this case? Are you kidding me? It's the same people involved. Trooper Guarino downloaded Farwell's phone and Trooper Fanning did a report and said they didn't find anything. Then the feds found 30,000 texts that led to his arrest for her murder. Bro, parasiting? Really?
And so they just throw out terms and words for our audience that's here on our right to try to create an illusion of impropriety. There is nothing that they have provided about the Birchmore case that will provide a basis for the Commonwealth to now go scramble and search for information that there's no good faith actually exists. It's easy to throw out a name and attach it to the Birchmore case, troopers, the DA, malign their name the way they know how to do. But when you're arguing a discovery motion, there must be a factual basis for it, a factual basis, a good faith basis. We hear the defense say that Trooper Guarino says, nothing to see here. I have not seen that report.
Farwell's phone was extracted by Nick Guarino. Trooper Guarino. On April 26th of 2021, Sergeant Fanning actually got his work cell phone from Stoughton Police Department. Now, his attorney consented for a data extraction that was performed by Guarino. Fanning analyzed both of those phones and didn't find anything. The report doesn't say nothing to see here. It says did not find any communication with Sandra Birchmore. That's what it says, which is actually probably worse. But continue.
I don't know what report they're speaking about when they suggest Trooper Guarino had done something wrong in a different case. They imply it. They're suggesting that's the basis for you to compel discovery on a case that has nothing to do with Ms. Reed's case. They just say it. And so you should reject outright an argument that tries to imply impropriety when there is none, with no factual basis or good faith basis, because they want to entertain our audience.
There's no possible way that he truly believes what he just said. There's no way. He's dramatic and he's sassy and he accuses the defense of doing all the things for the camera, but he literally lives for the camera to his right. But all of that aside, he's not dumb. He knows exactly what he's doing. And he knows what he is saying right now is complete BS. He has to. He takes his theatrical performance even further by saying that the only reason the defense is asking for the Sandra Birchmore material is because the harshness and sadness of that case is helpful for the defense. What a disgusting accusation. The only positive thing that I can say about Brennan at this point is that after this gross display before the court, He did say that he would take part in a call with the defense to request the information from Proctor's internal affairs investigation. Now, the defense wants that information before the trial starts, and that's good of Brennan to offer to do that. However, unless the hearing is finished, they may not even get anything turned over. And I've given you all the updates as we go, but Proctor had one hearing and then they set up another for a month later, and then they set up another for a month after that. So they aren't in a hurry with this thing, and it looks like they may be delaying it. Now keep in mind, they didn't suspend Proctor until after the first trial was over, so that couldn't be used against him in the first trial. Now, if he's still not at the point where a decision has been made, then they might not turn over the internal affairs stuff, and they might not be able to use that in the second trial. Ms. Little did ask the judge to order it, so we'll see how that one goes. And now the big one, the grand finale, the one that made the bomb go off in the courtroom. We'll be right back after this. Brennan gets up to argue the motion to exclude the ARCA witnesses. Now, I know a lot of you watch the hearings and then y'all blow up my DMs and email and website until I release the podcast episodes breaking it down. So a lot of you have seen this and understand what I'm about to describe. But if you didn't watch the hearing, let me paint the picture. I talk a lot about how theatrical Brennan is. Everything is a show, and this motion he's about to argue is the showiest of all the shows. He's dramatic, and he takes these long pauses for emotional effect while he shuffles papers and looks at the judge, like, can you believe what I just read? And it's incredibly frustrating for me, personally. Now, I'll edit out those long, unnecessary pauses in the clips that I play, but just know that this entire scene reads more like a stage play of a kid telling on his brother and then looking at his mom, waiting for her to send the little brother to his room without supper. Brennan presents this entire argument as a long, drawn-out gotcha moment. He begins by saying that he's not trying to deprive Karen Reed of an expert, although he's literally filed a motion to deprive her of every single expert, but he says that there's a minimum requirement of reciprocal discovery before a party can call a witness, and there has to be full disclosure when calling an expert. Brennan says it's interesting to him. Everything is interesting or curious to him, but he says it's interesting that the defense says that the information is unavailable to them, as in from the ARCA experts. We've been over this before, but he says that there are other things that are relevant to him as well.
Well, what the government worries about is that there is other things that are relevant, like compensation, promise, reward, inducement, whether there's collaboration between one side or the other. And that expert witness that they don't know about and can't ask about. That there's some type of bias or favoritism that the expert might have towards one side for whatever reason. So if that information is not disclosed, then it is not only an impediment, it creates a position where it is an unfair examination.
So here's what's about to happen. Brennan spends the next 10 minutes reading things in his theatrical, overly dramatized way, making a big production out of it. Now, he says that he wasn't at the last trial, but he's read the transcript, so he has a quote-unquote flavor of it. Now, he starts out by reading the transcripts of a conversation between Judge Cannone and David Unetti from June 10th. Now, this is trial day 22. This is when the issue with the ARCA experts not being able to give reciprocal discovery is first brought up. Here's the clip that he read.
Regarding the three experts from ARCCA. So I've read that report. I can't tell who does what or what the basis of their opinion is. So what have you provided?
Your Honor, we've provided everything that we know. We've mentioned to this court at sidebar, these experts did not arise from us.
I understand that.
These experts were hired by the federal government, and they provided a report to us pursuant to the TUI request, and it was specifically outlined that and ruled that they could not prep with us for trial.
So I'm to believe that the defense is calling three witnesses that you've never spoken to and putting them on the stand here
That's essentially it. We've spoken to them only for the purposes of coordination of their testimony and their background. That's it. We have not been able to interview them regarding their findings, which are outlined in detail in the reports that both sides have.
See, I don't see that as being, I don't see that as being detailed. It leaves a lot of questions as the gatekeeper as to what they can testify to. Well, and you have not complied with your Rule 14 obligations.
We can't, Your Honor. So, we can't.
So you can't, but you haven't. So I am left with, you haven't complied. So we need to get everybody here for voir dire. They can testify in voir dire, right?
Yes.
So Brennan says that he felt like there was much more to the story. So he called the federal government, 1-800-FEDS, and tried to encourage them to provide full discovery so that the experts could testify. Now, he says that he filed a TUI letter, basically a request from the feds for investigative materials, and he says he got a response that was unresponsive. Then, he says, Attorney McLaughlin wrote back to the feds again.
They didn't respond to our request, so Attorney McLaughlin wrote back, and then we got new materials, just some. But these materials are the very reason why the defense should not be able to call witnesses without giving full discovery.
Brennan says that there is a recent request from the defense to the ARCA experts. He says that this one is recent, so he has no issue with this one.
A recent request for their appearance pursuant to TUI, which I have no issue with.
Then he says that there are emails between Alan Jackson and Dr. Wolf, one of the ARCA experts.
So there is email correspondence between the defense, not only the federal government, but the ARCA witnesses themselves.
He reads the first email.
What we see back in March 22nd, 2024, is that there are conversations between the defense, Attorney Jackson, and Daniel Wolf, who's one of these ARCA witnesses. Thank you so much for taking the time to get on the phone with me this morning pursuant to our conversation. Please feel free to forward an engagement letter to this email address. I will get that countersigned and return to you forthwith along with your retainer as required.
Brennan says that the Commonwealth was not aware of any promises of compensation that were made. He said that that was never turned over and that they relied on the reciprocal discovery order and there was never anything said about payments being made from the defense to ARCA. Now, the next email that he reads is from Dr. Wolf back to Alan Jackson.
Response, hi, Alan. Subsequent to our conversation on Wednesday, the U.S. Attorney's Office asked we pause any further conversation until we received additional information from their office regarding how our involvement will move forward.
The next email is from June 22nd.
Saturday, June 22nd, Daniel Wolf writes, Alan, I spent some time this morning putting together a brief outline of my qualifications, also attached my D&T list. I obviously won't say what the response is verbatim, but I gave you a general sense of what my response would be. Again, I thought your questioning during the voir dire was fantastic, so please feel free to make whatever changes you feel necessary.
Then, Brennan tells Judge Cannone that this is all information that the defense did not turn over. This is information that he had to get from the feds.
Now, this isn't information provided by the defense in reciprocal discovery. This is information provided by the federal government after numerous requests, TUI requests, and an insistence, the best I can, to get as much information as I can.
He then reads an outline that he says is not dated.
An outline of questions and answers for a direct examination. The Commonwealth did not have the luxury to privilege, did not even know that there was an outline that was being disseminated by this totally independent witness who took no side other than that of the truth. What follows from this outline is then the outline with remarks from this independent expert who knows nobody. So we see in the margins in the notes, this fair-minded objective witness says, so not being able to inspect the vehicle is something that is not uncommon in your line of work. And he writes, absolutely not. And then he comments, not sure if you want to put this somewhere in the direct examination. I have a feeling they, the Commonwealth, are going to argue. I didn't personally inspect the vehicle. I had enough information from the material I reviewed, so it wasn't necessary. Need to show the jury it doesn't matter in this case.
What's the date of that?
It's not dated. It's not dated. The TUI request is a recent February response, but they send random documents. There's no real accounting.
He then reads another question with some comments from the outline.
Another comment. Would it be fair to say because you had a lot of nighttime visibility work, your cases frequently involve pedestrians? Yes, unfortunately, there is a direct correlation between the time of day and pedestrian fatalities. Statistically speaking, most pedestrian fatalities occur during the evening and night hours. That would have been nice to have. So my specialty in the area of lighting and human factors results in a lot of my cases involving pedestrians. Pretty important stuff in this case. And then he comments, if you don't want me to say this, that's fine. That's fine. Shh. Don't tell them.
And the third question from the outline.
Have you qualified as an expert in court before? Yes. I realized my testimony, I said it 20 times when you asked how many I've been qualified. I misinterpreted the question. My fault. 11 trials, 7 depositions. Not sure if you want me to clear that up. I don't know if it was ever cleared up.
Then he says that there is a bill from ARCA to the defense.
And then a bill from ARCA to the defense for $23,925. That's not Trimble. That's not trial by ambush. That's getting duped.
So to get an understanding of the implications here, Brennan just said that the two strongest witnesses for the defense's case, the two ARCA experts, are not fair or impartial. He says they're biased. He says that they've picked a side. And he says that there was witness communication and outlines of testimony that violate a federal order as well as discovery obligations from the defense. Now, Judge Cannone gets very upset. She immediately calls a recess and court is out of session for 30 minutes. When Judge Cannone comes back, she's out of breath and her hands are shaking so badly that she can barely hold her glasses. She then suspends court for the rest of the day.
So the Commonwealth just provided the court with information that causes me grave concern. The implications of that information may have profound effects on this defense and defense counsel. So for that reason, I'm going to suspend today so that when we meet again to address these issues, all affected will be appropriately prepared.
Profound effects on the defense and defense counsel. So immediately, everyone starts speculating if Jackson is going to get kicked off of this case, if he's going to have some kind of sanctions or lose his law license. I mean, people start going wild. The people who are supportive of Karen Reed start panicking that Jackson won't be able to represent her anymore. And the people who are against Karen Reed, oh, they start celebrating. They're spreading it all over social media that ARCA was paid off by the defense and they're not credible and Jackson lied and he's going to jail. It got crazy quick. Now, Judge Cannone asked Brennan for copies of all those materials that he just read, the ones that the Fed sent him that the defense withheld. And then, all of a sudden, Brennan needs to clear one little thing up.
I can, and there's a brief chronology I think Your Honor should be aware of. On February 11th, we filed the motion to exclude. February 13th, the defense provided us the emails that I read. February 13th, 2025, I think I said the federal government. It was the defense. February 13th, 2025, they sent us the emails and the direct examination outline.
That's right. The defense turned over the emails that were just read. Now, as a reminder, this is what Brennan said when he was representing this to the court.
Now, this isn't information provided by the defense in reciprocal discovery. This is information provided by the federal government after numerous requests, TUI requests, and an insistence the best I can to get as much information as I can.
He said this is not information from the defense, but it was, in fact, information from the defense. The judge issued a notice of appearance for the hearing for Tuesday, telling the defense to be ready to address the information that was turned over by them and be ready to address their prior representations to the court about ARCA. So let's take a look at what that will probably look like. On February 12th, 2024, the report with the findings from the three ARCA PhDs, Dr. Rentschler, Dr. Wolf, and Dr. Klein, is dated and turned over to the United States Attorney's Office.
As far as your opinion in your report, when was that issued?
February 12th of 2024.
So that date on the top of the report of February 12th, 2024, that's when you sent the report to the people that contracted you to do the analysis in the first place?
That's correct, yes, sir.
In February, 3,074 pages is turned over to the Commonwealth and the defense from the feds, including the ARCA report. The defense and the Commonwealth see this report for the first time. Alan Jackson brings this up, including the conclusions that they came to in a hearing on March 12th. This is before anybody had ever talked to an ARCA expert, and there had been no communication between the defense and ARCA or Lally and ARCA. Here are the conclusions that were in the report from the feds.
Now Mr. Lally has in his possession another thing from the feds that we didn't have access to. The federal investigators hired, independent of us, we had no idea, and independent of the Commonwealth, hired a professional reconstructionist, three PhDs, to look into exactly this issue. Did Karen Reed's car, did her SUV make contact with John O'Keefe? And their conclusion to a person was his injuries were inconsistent with the damage on the car. The damage on the car was inconsistent with having made contact with John O'Keefe's body. In other words, the car didn't hit him and he wasn't hit by the car. Period. Full stop. That's their independent expert, not ours.
So the defense gets this report. They realize that these third-party experts who are highly credentialed have come to the same conclusions that the defense has been saying all along, that Karen didn't do it. So 10 days after that hearing, the defense contacts ARCA to testify. Alan Jackson calls Dr. Wolf, tells him that he wants to have him come testify. He emails him afterwards to get it in writing. He says to Dr. Wolf that he can send the engagement letter and the required retainer. But Dr. Wolf responds that the attorney's office, the agency who hired them, said to pause and wait to hear back about their involvement moving forward. This is not shocking. The defense tried to hire ARCA, and ARCA was told to hold up. They got to wait because they're part of the U.S. Attorney's Office investigation. They can't just be hired by the defense. On June 10th, when Jannetty is asked in court by Judge Cannoni about his conversations with ARCA, he says, "We've spoken to them only for the purposes of coordination of their testimony and their background. That's it. We've not been able to interview them regarding their findings, which are outlined in detail in the reports that both sides have." That's when the judge says that she doesn't think that the details in the report are enough and she wants a voir dire. So a voir dire is held on June 18th. So here's the thing. The issues that were brought up are not what was represented by Brennan. Not only was it a huge deal that he accused the defense of withholding this information, but he was wrong. The conclusions that ARCA reached were narrowed down to three main bullet points that they were allowed to testify. Now, Judge Cannoni talked about the four specific conclusions that they had at the beginning of day 28 of the trial when she said that they could testify to the first three, but he wasn't allowed to testify to the fourth. That was the one about the head injuries. Only a medical doctor can do that. But all of the conclusions about how John was not hit by a car and the car did not hit John, all of those came directly from the report that was done in February before anybody had ever even talked to ARCA or knew that they existed. The U.S. Attorney's Office let the defense and the Commonwealth know that their contract with ARCA ended in July. So if they wanted to retain ARCA for further analysis, that was fine. But their previous testing and findings are still sealed. So the defense reached out to ARCA again and asked them to testify in this trial as well. Now, think about it. The Commonwealth filed the motion to exclude ARCA on February 11th, and the defense turned over their discovery for ARCA on February 13th. The stuff that they included, like these emails, is stuff that they turned over. That's part of their discovery. When Jannetty said that they talked to the experts about their background and coordinating testimony, part of the background is Dr. Wolf's experience with night visibility. So the little comment that Brennan made about how that would have been nice to know, well, he would know it if he watched the first trial.
So I do a lot of nighttime visibility work where, for instance, let's say a pedestrian's coming onto the roadway at night. Maybe it's not a lit roadway and you're relying on your vehicle headlights to illuminate that pedestrian. So it's determining when would a driver recognize that individual on the roadway based upon the headlights, if there is any artificial lighting, their clothing. And then we look at how do drivers respond based upon that scenario that they're presented with.
When Brendan read this to the judge, he read it like this is some big conspiracy to keep all of this information out. Here's Dr. Wolf saying exactly that. So all of the, oh, that would have been nice to know, and that's pretty important. Well, yeah, that's why it was said.
Fair to say because you had a lot of nighttime visibility work, your cases frequently involve pedestrians. Yes, unfortunately, there is a direct correlation between the time of day and pedestrian fatalities. Statistically speaking, most pedestrian fatalities occur during the evening and night hours. That would have been nice to have.
A great deal of my work is in the field of lighting and visibility. So there's a direct correlation between time of day and pedestrian incidents. We see a rise in the evening and night hours just due to drivers having a difficult ability to try to perceive and recognize individuals.
So my specialty in the area of lighting and human factors results in a lot of my cases involving pedestrians. Pretty important stuff in this case. And then he comments, if you don't want me to say this, that's fine. That's fine. Shh. Don't tell them.
So I certainly see a lot of pedestrian collisions in my casework.
When Lally asked about it, Dr. Wolf explained that it wasn't part of the scope of this case. He didn't hide this. There's no, shh, don't tell them. He was very clear during the voir dire about this. And this question is directly related to his background. His background. That's something that the attorneys are allowed to talk about. This is not forbidden fruit. The comment about not being able to inspect the vehicle but still having enough information, it's not surprising that the expert's saying that he wants it to be very clear what he had and what he needed in order to do his testing. Any good expert would want that to be clear. And the comment about misrepresenting how many times he had testified because he got confused on the question. He said that during voir dire. That's not a question about his testing or his findings. This is, once again, his background, and this was done after the voir dire, which this is allowed to be asked. Lally asked very specifically what they were allowed to talk about and what they're not, and this is what Dr. Rentschler said.
At some point, you were made aware that your report and your findings were made available to both the prosecution and the defense in this case, correct?
I was made aware of that, yes, sir.
And when you were made aware of that, was there any limitations on given to you as far as who you could discuss your report, your findings, or anything with?
Yeah, basically, given the direction or the request that I don't actually discuss the substance of my opinions or my report with anybody aside from who we were originally retained to work for.
So he can't discuss the substance of his opinions or report with anybody. But none of that stuff that Brennan read included anything about the substance of his report or his opinions. And as far as the bill, it's a bill, not a receipt. Dr. Wolf and Alan Jackson both confirmed during the trial that the defense had not paid them anything. Jackson even confirmed it again after court was suspended Tuesday. A bill is not a receipt. And if the bill is for expenses to get them there to testify and pay for the hotel and travel or whatever, that's fine. That's something that has to be turned over in discovery. And, oh yeah, Jackson turned it over in discovery. It seems like the judge having such an emotional reaction and Brennan being so dramatic about his false gotcha moment caused a huge stir. It worked. I think it had the exact effect that he wanted it to. Now the world is talking about this and focusing on the defense and trying to discredit the ARCA witnesses in their minds, and there's all this noise. So now, people are no longer focusing on all those discovery violations from the Commonwealth. Isn't that curious, as Brennan would say? ARCA is one of the top engineering firms in the nation, if not the top. They are trusted by NASA, the U.S. military, McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Manufacturing, the United States Attorney's Office, FEMA, the National Hockey League, just to name a few. If you think that some prosecutor in Massachusetts and an online smear campaign is going to ruin their credibility, well, maybe it's time to take a step back and reevaluate what's real and what's not. We'll find out the truth on Tuesday. We'll find the dates of the report, the information behind the bill, and how much of this whole production was just set up as a distraction to keep the attention off of the mess that the Commonwealth and law enforcement has made in this case. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.